This is the Pitch Vision My Cricket Coach Show, number 38. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision My Cricket Coach Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com and email us on mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. My name's David Hinchliffe in the UK.
And I'm Kevin Sampath from Australia. Coming up on the show, Ian Poynt answers one of your fast bowling questions, and as usual, we answer the listeners' questions. Well, David, this week, the theme for the show is mental toughness, and I believe we've seen a recent example of that. And I'm sure you're pretty happy about that as well.
Well, yeah, the first Ashes test was very enjoyable watching for me, but I'm not sure about watching for you. Did you stay up and watch it all night?
I stayed up until the wee hours of 3:30 in the morning, having to wake up for work at 6 o'clock. And Let me tell you, I had my phone ready to send a message to all my English-following mates about an Australian win. And all of a sudden, they pulled it out of nowhere, and I was shattered. Went to bed an unhappy man. One specific point that people brought up was, well, there was a lot of argument about time wasting and everything, but Andrew Strauss said that every time the 12th man and the physio went down into the middle, they said that those two batsmen were extremely focused. So no matter how many times anything the Australians threw at them, they would just be focused on their task. And I think that has a lot to do with mental toughness, because they were really resilient and focus on the task ahead, not getting distracted by any of the bounces or anything anyone else was throwing at them. What would you have to say about that, David? Is mental toughness a big thing, or is technique coming there as well?
I think in that kind of situation where it's gone down to the wire like that, it's all down to, I mean, there's a certain element of luck, of course. Mm-hmm. Bad luck on the side of Australia and good luck on the side of England. But if you take that out of the equation, you know, I think really what it all boils down to is, you know, how much you can stick to doing the job. You know, if you're a spinner and you've bowled 30 odd overs in a day and you're bowling the last over or the second last over of the match, and suddenly, you know, you get tired and you lose your spinning fingers and you haven't got that last dreg you can pull out from somewhere, then I think that's mental toughness, because the mind gives up long before the body does, because we've got sort of a built-in system to make sure that we don't drain our resources down to zero, because otherwise, if we did that, we'd, you know, be in serious trouble of getting very seriously injured or very badly hurt or something like that. So the mind has a sort of a safety trigger to make sure that you never get down that low in terms of energy. So even though you think you're completely drained, the body's still got plenty more in it if it needs it. It's just that it doesn't have access to it anymore because the mind's cut it off. So if you can, you know, if you can have that mental strength to keep going, then I think that's what makes the difference in those kind of situations. So that's why we've gone for this theme this week of mental toughness, just to talk about it in all different ways, really, and see if the inspiration of the England players can sort of trickle down to whatever level that the people who are listening to this could play at. And that could be, you know, even down to under 11s, a 20 over under 11s match on a Tuesday evening.
So you've been playing on the weekend, David. Any good news or any bad news? Any signs of mental toughness?
Well, yeah, I had to put my own version of mental toughness into action this week, because yet again we were rained off. Horrible storms and weather made sure that we didn't even get to the ground again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, another week. That's 2 weeks in a row where we've trained. The weather's been all right in the week, so we've trained, and then we haven't played. What have you been up to?
Well, believe it or not, for the people listening, I am not the perfect cricketer. And last week we were chatting about something about the batting grip.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a look at my batting grip over the week, and I decided, well, you were talking about the perfect batting grip, so I decided to give that a go. And so I tried it, which was, as mentioned last week, forming a V by pointing your thumb and forefinger down between the outside edge
yep.
and center of the back of the bat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I tried that in the nets and while practicing at home as well. And it felt really weird at first, but then I had a lot more front arm control, I found out. Because in my previous grip, it was really evenly split. And most of the times, my backhand became more dominant, which meant me hitting in the air a lot more and not having total control of my shots. But
yeah.
trying this out, it felt really weird, but I felt that I had control of my shots. And I could still hit sort of my power shots or my slog shots. But I could right. also play smoothly on my drives and my blocks and all that. So, yeah, it was really good trying out this. But I think it'll take a lot more practice for me to perfect it. Because I found heaps of flaws where I couldn't get my bat down in time. Yeah, it just takes, it's going to take a lot of practice.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing, of course, is that the grip is very closely associated with the stance and the back lift or the back swing, as it's called nowadays. So those things have to be right as well. You can have the perfect grip, but if your balance is too far over to the offside, you keep falling over, you're having to play around your front pad all the time, then it doesn't matter how good your grip is.
Yeah.
And the same as if your back swing goes up behind your body, goes back over leg stump. Again, you're closing yourself off. You can't get to the ball. You've got no access to the ball. So they're all those three areas are very closely linked in grip, stance, and backlift. The setup, if you like, they're all very closely linked into each other. So yeah, it'll take work thinking about each one of those in turn and trying to get the right balance for you. That's not only feels right, but also gives you the best results.
Yeah, that's right. It's all. I think getting the balance is all about practice as well, because I found it worked well at the start, but I kept going back to old habits when I was at the Nets last week. So, yeah, it's sort of muscle memory, isn't it? Or like training my brain to think the right way.
Yeah, top hand is so important. You know, if you get the top hand control right, you've got such a great range of shots.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult. It's
exactly.
very difficult because it's so tempting. It's so natural for your bottom hand to come in. And then you're closing the face and you're playing across the ball and all silly things like that. So you've got to play as much as possible with the full face of the bat with straight bat shots. And if the only way you're going to do that is to control the shot with your top hand and you bring the bottom hand in at the right moment. Because if you bring it in too early, then you're in all kinds of trouble. Unless you are extremely talented, got really good hand-eye coordination, but you know, most people aren't in the bracket of brilliant hand-eye coordination and can get away with it.
Yeah, that's right. Some of my friends mentioned to me in the Nets, I'm Kevin Sampath, not Kevin Peterson.
Oh, well, there you go, exactly.
Yeah. All right, before we get into the question section for mental toughness today, Ian Pond's back with a fast bowling tip for us, so let's have a listen to what he has to say.
Hi, Ian, great to have you back.
Hi, David.
Modern cricket demands that even the big hairy quick bowlers throw themselves around in the field now. Does this requirement lead to less recovery time, more fatigue, and therefore less accurate bowling?
Crikey, there's four questions in one there. And what's this big hairy fast bowler business? If we go back to when cricket was in black and white, let's say, back into the 60s and 70s, I think what you saw was certainly fast bowlers being incredibly protected. To the point where you just didn't expect them to throw themselves around in the field. I wouldn't, for example, have seen someone like Fred Truman. I couldn't imagine him diving full length mid-on trying to stop a cricket ball. He would say, you know, that's not my job. What's happened, the modern game now dictates that all 11 players in a team should be fielders. There's no room anymore for passengers.
Yeah.
And that was probably brought home to me about 8 years ago or so, when I saw Glenn McGrath fielding for Australia, and the ball went to the fence, and he produced one of the most magnificent full-length dives in the outfield that I've seen. But the fact that it was from a big, hairy, fast bowler, as you call him, was amazing. I mean, he threw himself full-length. He's not a small man. He got down. It was a couple of inches off the turf, held it one-handed. And I thought that would be a great catch for even a Collingwood or a Herschel Gibbs or a Jonty Rhodes. I mean, it was a seriously good catch. And what we've learned as cricketers, David, now is that every run you save is a run you don't have to score yourself. To the point where you can't afford to have a fast bowler who isn't a great fielder. Now, the flip side of that is if you've got your fast bowler who you're trying to protect and keep him on the field as long as possible because he's a weapon, if you have him throwing himself around willy-nilly and diving on hard outfields, etc., you know, by default, they're going to injure themselves at some stage. I mean, it may not be literally from a piece of fielding that injures them, but they're putting themselves at risk of injury, and over time they're going to take knocks, bumps, bruises, shoulders, knees, elbows, back, etc. So, you know, I think we've got to be careful that bowlers aren't just throwing themselves at a lost cause ball to save one or two runs, when the downside of trying to do that might be they miss two or three matches coming up. Yeah. But, you know, for the life of me, I can't think any cricketers taking the field thinking, should I dive for this one or not? I might get injured. I don't think any of that ever enters anybody's head. So, part of the hazard, I think, now of really good fielding in cricket around the world, club cricket, county cricket, international stuff, is that you're going to get all of your cricketers diving around in the field. And I don't think there's room anymore for fast bowlers who don't do that. So we will see a higher prevalence of injury, perhaps. We will see a few more broken digits from guys trying to attempt amazing catches. We'll also see knees and ankles getting twisted in outfields as people throw themselves around, sliding, etc. All I would say is if you're involved with a team and you are involved on the fielding coaching side of a team, is to teach everybody how to do those skills correctly. I tell you what, David, I see a lot of youngsters trying to mimic people sliding in the field or diving in the field, and they don't do it correctly. They literally throw themselves at the ball. There's a way of doing it. And if you've got a big fast bowler, he is one of the guys you really need to teach how to field properly. But whether it affects their – I mean, part of the question was, does it affect their accuracy? I mean, yeah, clearly it could, because if you're taking a knock and you're carrying an injury or you've jarred your elbow or something, yeah, it can affect what you do. But I think overall we're in a phase of world cricket right now where you can't afford to have too many passengers in the field. So your big, hairy, fast bowler, I'm afraid, is going to have to get his whites dirty.
Thank you, Ian, for your time. If you want coaching from Ian Pond, you can access PitchVision Academy's How to Bowl Faster coaching course from www.pitchvision.com/academy. Welcome to the listeners' question section. This week's theme is mental toughness, and as always, you can tap into the wealth of knowledge in PitchVision Academy by accessing the How to Use Mental Training to Boost Your Game course, written by David himself on www.pitchvision.com/academy. So let's get into the questions. Our first question, David, is from David. For my club, First 11, we play in Division 2 in the Kent League. A few years ago, we were a Premier League side, but were relegated to Division 3 in successive years. Last year, however, we fought back and were promoted to Division 2 again. We're struggling again now and are in and out of the relegation zone all the time. Having experienced the high of winning the league and being promoted last year, our First 11 simply can't cope with regularly losing matches in Division 2. Our side, without doubt, has the talent to play in higher leagues again, but our skipper is losing all hope and subsequently the rest of the team is doubting our ability. It's now a matter of mental strength and stamina, which we are lacking as a team. All right, David, this first part, does it all start with the captain, where if the captain is down and sort of lacking in mental toughness and lacking in confidence, does that spread onto the team and sort of leads the team to lack in mental confidence and toughness?
Absolutely. The captain has a really important role to play here. The captain's the leader. So you need someone who is taking leadership in this situation. And the obvious example of that is the captain, because the captain is the appointed leader. That doesn't necessarily mean that everybody else has no responsibility in this, because they say, it's a bit of a cliche, but it's true, they say that the best teams, everyone is the captain. You know, there's 11 captains on the field. And that what that really means is that everybody is taking responsibility for the entire team. You've got your captain there, but everybody else is taking a great responsibility as well. So, it's a complicated area, definitely. Though it's not, you can't just turn around and go, "Oh well, we've got a captain who's a bit down because we're losing games, so therefore, we're not going to be very good this year." Because it's about the dynamic between all the different players, you know, the interaction between all the different players, and that can get complicated because everybody's got a different personality. So that's why it's key for the captain to be able to understand all those different personalities, try and get under the skin of those people and work out how they tick, and then try and influence them to work together more. Now, you can't make people, you can't trick people into working together in a better way, but you can influence them if you know how people tick. Some people only perform if you tell them they're bowling really terribly and, you know, you give them a kick up the butt. While other people, they need an arm around the shoulder. That's the classic thing between different personalities. But there's a lot of different types of personalities. Yeah. That's just two ways of dealing with people. So if the captain doesn't already know that, it should be his job to find that out as quickly as possible. And one good way to quickly find that out, and sort of in an emergency situation like that, when you're halfway through the season, is to get everyone together, get the whole team together, ideally the whole squad. You know, if you've got in English cricket, you've got a first 11, second 11, as you know, Kevin, and maybe third 11, maybe fourth 11. Probably over the course of a season, you'll use 15 or 16 players, maybe, across players who only play in the first 11 and players who play a bit in the first and a bit in the second and players who only play in the second, but maybe they come in at the last minute if someone gets injured or something. So maybe you've got 16 players there. As much as possible, get them all together. Maybe that's, you know, after a training session, or maybe it's before the game on a Saturday morning, or somehow get everybody together. And then take the lead in saying to everybody, right, how are we going to get out of this? What can we do to sort our problems and start performing well again? And as much as possible, give everybody a voice. Give everybody the chance to make the suggestions of what they think can get the team out of the trouble. Because you never know. Somebody who you never thought would make a good suggestion could come up with a brilliant answer. Well, why don't we try bowling Bob a little bit more? Because I think Bob is the right sort of bowler for these type of conditions. Something really simple it might be. But it could be enough to get... Now then, once you've got all those suggestions, once you've got all those ideas, once you've got all those gripes, all those problems, all those questions, whatever it is, then the captain has to take the leadership with all that and decide what's going to happen. Because you can't have captaincy by committee. You can have a meeting, everyone can air their views, problems can be solved in those sort of meetings. But when you're out in the middle, you can't have six or seven people coming up to the captain making loads of different suggestions, and somebody setting the field and somebody else changing the bowling and somebody else trying to bowl outside off stump while the captain set a leg side field and all the rest of it. So the captain has to be strong. The captain has to make the decision. The captain has to know when to say, right, this is what we're doing here.
Coming back to that, David, a recent example was Ricky Ponting in India when the Australians played in India, and a lot was said about Ricky Ponting's body language that transferred onto his team. I mean, when things were going really bad, Ricky Ponting showed really bad body language and he didn't look confident at all. And from that, his bowlers didn't bowl really well. His batsmen didn't really stand up. And a lot of the older players were doubting whether Ponting's attitude affected the players' performances. So yeah, I guess the captain is really sort of someone the players look up to, and if he isn't confident, if he isn't showing that toughness, that mental toughness, then the players simply have no chance.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not only that, it's also, that's okay. I mean, you can get away with that maybe if you know that your body language will motivate the players to try harder.
Yeah.
If you know that your star bowler looks to you to see how he's bowling, and if you're, you know, clapping your hands and going, oh, you know, you're bowling really well, Jim, or, you know, keep trying, or whatever it is, and he thinks, well, I must be doing okay, but he's not, he's doing badly.
Yeah.
Then he's not going to try any harder to bowl well. Whereas if you're all downcast and looking a bit sort of arms crossed and sort of not making eye contact, he takes that as his cue to try a little bit harder. Yeah. You've not said anything to him, but just by your body language, you've made it clear that you're not happy. So yeah. It depends on the personality. Now, another person might think, oh, God, the captain's given up on me. I might as well not bother myself. And then he just starts bowling a load of long hops and half volleys. But it depends on the personality. So you have to know that as a captain. You have to know when to go to a bowler and talk to him. You have to know when to leave a bowler alone. You have to know when to get suggestions from people. And you have to know when to ignore those suggestions. And you have to know if you ignore someone's suggestion that they're not going to go off in a huff because you've ignored it.
Yeah.
So it's all about, to me, it's all about personality. And you do have to be a strong leader, but being a strong leader doesn't necessarily mean shouting and screaming and clapping and you know, being sort of the sergeant major type. You can lead that kind of thing to your wicketkeeper. Most wicketkeepers enjoy doing that. I think the main job of the captain is to understand how his players tick and try and get the best out of them by knowing the personality of those particular players.
All right. So the second part of David's question, David, was he starts talking about his own game and he says, I'm a very optimistic person off the field and a positive player on the field. I used to play for my county from the ages of 10 to 17 and still have aspirations of returning. I'm now 20. Over the past 3 years, however, my contacts have gradually faded away. Other commitments have stood in the way and I've found other excuses to justify why I haven't fought back, one of them being that my club is suffering. As part of my four-year degree, I'm working full-time for my third year. I'm finding it tough to train regularly and my fitness is starting to suffer. I'm beginning to think it's just a dream and my family have stopped believing in me. Now, is it a mental thing or is it not? It's difficult to know how to hold it together. But David, we have a few examples of people working and studying and playing cricket at the same time as well. One of them in one of your case studies as well. So is it really a mental toughness thing or is it about setting realistic goals?
I think it is completely a mental thing. The reason why I think that in this case is that the core of this problem is that there's stress between what is actually happening and what he wants to happen. So there's a difference in reality between what is actually happening and what he wants to happen, and that's causing him stress. So the simple answer is to either change reality so it matches what he wants or change what it wants so it matches reality. That way he won't be stressed out anymore. He'll have what he's doing there is he's got an agreement with himself. Basically, he's made an agreement with himself, just like you would make an agreement with a friend to go to the cinema, say. If you didn't turn up to the cinema, your friend might get a bit annoyed with you, wouldn't they? I mean, if you said I'll see you at 7 and then just didn't turn up, your friend would get annoyed with you.
Yeah.
And the same as if you said I'll see you at 7, your friend said yes, you arrived, and your friend didn't turn up, you'd get annoyed with them.
Yeah.
Well, it's exactly the same. You make agreements with yourself as much as you do with other people, probably more, in fact. So he's made an agreement with himself to play county cricket, but he can't meet that commitment. He can't turn up to the cinema at 7 o'clock anymore. So he's angry with himself. So all he needs to do is renegotiate that agreement with himself. Just like if you couldn't turn up to the cinema to see your friend, if you phoned him the day before and said, sorry, mate, I can't make it now. Let's do it next week. Your mate will go, oh, okay, fair enough, and that'll be fine. He needs to renegotiate the agreement with himself. So he needs to decide which way he needs to renegotiate it. Does his aspiration is to play county cricket? Is that a realistic aspiration, considering all the problems that he's got at the moment, such as he's doing a degree, he can't train as much as he wants, he's lost contacts, he doesn't know who the new contacts are. Those are the problems he's having. If those problems are insurmountable, which they could well be, that's fine. You know, it's not a problem. We all have problems which are insurmountable. Then he needs to renegotiate his agreement with himself and set himself a lower target. However, if those problems aren't insurmountable, if he still wants to do it so much that he feels he can overcome those problems, then he needs to work out how he's going to get over those problems. How can he get to the gym more often? There are tricks you can do to get to the gym more often. We know that, right? Or you train more often. We've talked about this before. There are ways of reestablishing contacts with people in the county game. It might just be a matter of making a couple of phone calls. We don't know exactly what the problem is. Or he may just decide to delay it for a year until he's finished his course. Or 2 years, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So there's ways of doing it, but he has to, whichever way he goes, he has to decide to go one way or the other, renegotiate that agreement with himself, and that will then remove the stress, which is what's really causing the problem. The stress is the bit that people can't stand. It's not the problem that people can't stand. It's the stress of the problem that people can't stand. So if you can get rid of that stress by renegotiating the agreement, then you'll be 90% of the way there to solving the problem.
All right, David, our next question is from Philip, and he plays for his state team as a two-down batter, and he says that every time he's out there playing, someone inside him says that he can do it, but at the same time, someone inside him is telling him that he can't do it. And he says that if he's doing well, he can't bat for a long time. And I know that's a common problem there nowadays, where there's really talented batsmen, but they just can't seem to hang in for a while. So what would you recommend for him in terms of mental toughness, David?
Well, I was talking about this the other day to somebody. I think cricket is unique in that if you're batting, you only get one chance. If you're out, that's it, you have to go. You only get one chance. I can't think of another sport. I might be wrong here, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I can't think of another sport where you get one chance and that's it, it's all over.
Yeah.
You know, even the closest I can come up with is baseball, and that you get three chances. On the third go, you're out. So, that's the thought of that is very stressful. I mean, I'm no top quality batsman, not by any stretch of the imagination. And the thought of that, you know, everyone is standing there waiting to bat, feeling nervous. I don't think anybody suffers from zero nerves at all. Because you always have that thing in your mind where you think, well, what if I'm out first ball? And I think for batting wise, I think that is the mark of someone truly with mental toughness, when you can, as much as possible, put the negative out of your mind and keep the positive in your mind. I think that really is the hallmark of someone with good mental toughness. You know, some of the great batsmen over the years with good mental toughness, Steve Waugh, of course, springs to mind. You know, he just kept going no matter what. You know, no matter what was happening, he would just keep going, wouldn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
But I'm sure he had doubts in his mind as well. I'm sure everyone does, but it's the ability to put them out of your mind and keep batting, ignoring what's going on, and just keep facing ball after ball. That's the hallmark of a mentally tough person. It makes it easier if you've done well before, because if you've done well before, you've got a pool of memory to call back of what happened when you were doing well. So, you know, in times of strife, when you're out of form or you're fearful of doing badly, you've got that memory of scoring a brilliant 100 or, you know, even a 50 or whatever it was to call back. So as he said, if he's a state player, I mean, he doesn't say what level state he's playing, but if he's a state player, chances are he's had some success at some level somewhere along the line. So a good place to start is to think back on those times and remember what it was like to be successful and feel confident and know that you're on top of the bowling and know that you're doing well. If he hasn't, and a lot of people listening to this might be in a similar situation, but they've never had a big score behind them, especially if you're a younger player, then you can still use the same trick. You can still think back to success, but you can imagine it rather than remembering it, if you see what I mean. Because there's no difference in the subconscious mind, which is where this all happens. There's no difference between something that you remember and something that you imagine. So you can sort of sneakily imagine yourself scoring 100. I mean, I'm sure everyone's done it, especially younger people. You know, you lie in bed at night and dream of scoring a brilliant 100 in an Ashes Test match or whatever it is. Well, yeah. that's actually quite a productive thing to do. If you're lying in bed anyway, you know, you might as well dream of scoring a brilliant 100 in an Ashes Test match or whatever the equivalent is for you. So, because that helps, because it's all positive. It's all positive images in your mind. And the more positive images that you can put into your mind, the more your mind gets used to those images and the more you're used to doing well even before you step onto the pitch. So if you can keep those images in your mind before you play, even during play, then you're halfway there. The other half is being able to keep the negative images out. Especially if you do something wrong, you know, you play a injudicious shot and you hit the ball somewhere it shouldn't be hit, but you get away with it. Or perhaps you just start to think back to when you last got out against a left-arm bowler like this chap and he was, you know, he got you out easily because, you know, you nicked off because you weren't used to the angle. You start thinking like that, then you're in a bit of trouble. So you have to be able to put those things out of your mind. How do you put those things out of your mind? We use this technique called the stop technique, which is very simple. I've talked about it before a while back. As soon as you discover yourself thinking a negative thought, then you think to yourself something very dramatic, like a red traffic light or a stop sign, something like that. You think stop, and then you just bring back a good image in your mind, like, you know I can play this bowler, or, you know, I've scored 100 on this ground before, or something like that. And you just put that negative thought out of your mind. And if you do that every time, then before long, you will learn to push those things out of your mind as soon as they come into your mind. So those would be the two areas that I would look at. And we cover those two areas in quite a lot of detail in the How to Use Mental Training to Boost Your Game course on Pitch Vision Academy. So if you want to know a lot more detail about that and also some methods that we use to keep positive and ignore the negative, then have a look at the course.
The question section this week was to reiterate mental toughness in cricket. And if you want to tap into the wealth of knowledge provided by Pitch Vision Academy, you can access the How to Use Mental Training to Boost Your Game course on www.pitchvision.com/academy. Before we leave you for today, though, we'd like to thank Seajax for their fabulous music that livens up the show. And don't forget that you can catch all the articles, updates, forums, and anything you hear about on the show on www.pitchvision.com. Stay tuned for our next show on the 24th of July with the theme being batting technique. And so if you have any questions or feedback to add to that, or in general, please email us at mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. That's mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. Thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. So signing off from Sydney, Australia, this is Kevin Sampath.
And this is David Hinchliffe in the UK.
The My Cricket Coach Show is a copyright-protected production for Pitch Vision. For more information, please visit pitchvision.com.